Thank you for joining us on EAA Radio, the voice of EAA. I'm Wireless Mike.
And I'm Paul.
And we're joined by Rich Mamrosch from the National Weather Service. Did I get it right?
You got it right.
All right. Practice makes perfect.
How's it going, Rich?
Pretty good.
Good. Thanks for coming here.
And what do you do at the National Weather Service?
At the National Weather Service, I'm a lead forecaster at the office in Green Bay, Wisconsin. It's one of 122 National Weather Service forecast office. We issue tornado, severe thunderstorm, blizzard warnings, but we also do terminal forecasts for aviation. And for this part of Wisconsin, we issue the terminal forecasts for Oshkosh, Appleton, Green Bay, and Rhinelander.
So one office to create all of those weather for lots of places in the state.
Correct.
Okay, I always thought there was a guy sitting here doing all that here in Oshkosh. Yeah.
So, Rich, I mean, just like everything in aviation, there's an expanse of technology that has gone, you know, over the years where, you know, we rely heavily on technology. What are some of the changes that you've seen over the past few years to make your work easier?
Well, in the 27 years I've worked for the Weather Service, we've gone from computer models that run like twice a day that offer output out to 3 or 4 days to ones that run every hour. And we have some computer models now that go out for a couple of weeks. We also have much better satellite technology. And the thing I'm going to talk about today is we're using an ever-increasing number of commercial aircraft as platforms for our weather data.
Tell us about that.
About 20 years ago, we did an experiment where we put some, more or less like 8-track tape recorders on some wide-bodied aircraft that were flying across the ocean to try to record temperature and wind data across the oceans, which are pretty data sparse. And over the past 20 years, we've got that automated where the data flow through the ACAR system from ARINC. And so we've got about 3,000 aircraft worldwide that send back wind and temperature data as they ascend and descend and during level flight that go back to the National Weather Service and the other meteorological centers around the world.
So 3,000 aircraft, that's a lot of aircraft. I mean, is that coming from basically every airline who's equipped with this, or do you have certain agreements with various airlines?
Yeah, we have certain agreements. Right now, the U.S. Participating airlines are American, United, Southwest, FedEx, UPS, and one more, and Delta. We're trying to expand it to other, especially regional carriers, because we'd like to get more atmospheric sounding data from some of the smaller cities that are served, for example, say like Bemidji or Rhinelander or Ironwood.
And I'm assuming you just get agreements with them, and then, I mean, the data is already being collected by the airplane pretty much at this point, right?
Yeah, you pretty much are just taking your outside air temperature from the aircraft, and then if they've got a GPS or inertial navigation system, you can calculate the ground relative wind speed. So the aircraft has the data anyway. The only expense is downlinking it to the ground and processing it, and we share the cost 50-50 with the airlines.
So you're obviously then, since you have these platforms that are sending you data almost on a real-time basis, computer modeling must be much be more accurate.
Oh yeah, since the weather information from the commercial aircraft were ingested into the computer models, they've gotten quite a bit better. And in the past 10 years, that's the reason we're able to run computer models every hour. We only send up weather balloons every 12 hours at places around the world, but we're getting these aircraft data, you know, every minute or two from some of the big hubs. So now we have enough information where we can run them every hour.
And there must be a central server which is taking all of this data?
Yeah, it goes through ACARS into ARINC, I think in Annapolis, Maryland. And then it goes to the National Weather Service and to the FAA, and it gets into our, you know, data stream. And forecasters in the weather forecast offices can use it directly. And then it also goes into the computer models.
So I'd imagine this is much cheaper than actually using weather balloons, and much better information.
It's pretty much identical to weather balloons as far as quality. In fact, the wind information is even deemed, you know, better than what you get from a weather balloon, and it is a lot more expensive. A sounding from an aircraft is on the order of maybe 10 cents, where sending up a weather balloon for the instrument, the balloon, the gas, the parachute, and whatnot is about $300.
So are you actually going to get to a point where you might stop doing weather balloons at certain locations?
That's a possibility. So far, we haven't been able to do that because the people that study global warming and climate change, they want data from 80,000 or 100,000 feet above the ground, and commercial aircraft only fly up to about 40,000.
Sure. So there's obviously limitations in using the aircraft, and doesn't get you everything you're looking for.
Right, but it does give us a lot, and as we get more and more aircraft, our forecast should become better and better.
So the only thing you're actually getting is the temperature, the altitude they're at, and the wind at that altitude. It seems to me that that's would help with the model, but how exactly does that help create with the model? Just in how the weather is flowing through the airspace?
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of what drives the weather at the surface is what's happening aloft, especially with the jet stream and little jet streaks that move through the jet stream. And if you send up a weather balloon, say, in Minneapolis and in Green Bay and in Detroit twice a day, there is, you're only sampling a very small part of the atmosphere, and there's big gaps where you really don't know what the wind is in between these places. So if you've got all these aircraft flying around, thousands of them at a given time, you get a much more finer scale of information, and that just makes the models better.
Does the amount of data that you're able to access, does that change when you're anticipating some significant weather event, such as a winter storm or a hurricane or tropical storm development? I mean, are you able to get more data when you need it, or are you just looking at the same quantity of data regardless of the event type?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, it's kind of the other way around, where if, say, they know there's going to be a blizzard in the Northeast, and then the airlines start pulling planes out of Boston and New York and whatnot, then the amount of data gets reduced.
Okay.
It's not a big problem, though, because by that time, the computer models and the forecasts are pretty much already done, and they're generally good at that point. But yeah, during a blizzard, during a landfalling hurricane or whatnot, there's basically no aircraft data because there's nobody flying around.
So what's your interface then with the National Hurricane Center?
Well, the National Hurricane Center is part of the National Weather Service.
Okay.
And they use a lot of this aircraft data over the Gulf and out over the Caribbean and whatnot to put into the models. And that's some of the information that makes the models better, because you get a better idea of what the winds are up at 30 or 40,000 feet that sometimes kind of steer the hurricanes and tropical systems, and then sometimes cause them to either intensify or diminish.
I suppose the more and more data you get, and the more you can look at the models versus what actually happens, the better you can make your models, so the more accurate the forecast will be.
Right. And in some places now, we have more data than the models were designed to accept. So we're kind of overloading the computer models with more information than they were designed to handle. But we're kind of working on that now so that they can, really utilize what we're getting.
So you're updating the model to handle the more information so that we can get even better forecasts.
Right. One thing that's new, so we're putting water vapor sensors on aircraft. We've got about 120 Southwest and UPS 737s that have water vapor sensors. So from those aircraft, we're getting temperature, wind, and water vapor information.
So you can then better predict precipitation events and, the general condition of the atmosphere then.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah, that's our main problem that we have in predicting thunderstorms and whatnot is just we don't have a precise knowledge of where the water vapor is in the atmosphere.
Sure.
And how long have you been utilizing the water vapor sensors?
The water vapor sensor started on a small scale about 7 or 8 years ago, but now that we've rapidly expanded the numbers, and we're going to continue to do so.
Yeah, so, we've been speaking with Rich from the National Weather Service, and just another follow-up question, Rich. In addition to the improvements in computer modeling for forecast, are there other improvements that have come along for the general aviation pilot in general in terms of the products that you offer?
It helps us make better terminal forecasts, and it helps the Aviation Weather Center issue better AirMets and SIGMETs. What I would like to see personally is to make the information public domain, where a pilot can go on a website and then look at all this real-time data themselves. So if you're going to take off from Appleton or Oshkosh or whatever, and a commercial aircraft just took off, you would be able to get that information from the aircraft that just left. Right now, it's not public domain, but if we reimburse the airlines the full cost of the data transmission, then it would become so. And that might happen in the next couple of years.
Sure. So how much, I know funding is always an issue in the government, but how much more of an expense would that be? Are we talking hundreds of dollars or billions of dollars?
No. Like something in between. I think it's about $200,000 or $300,000 a year that the Weather Service pays and the airlines pay. So it's around that amount. And if we could do that, then the information would be available to GA pilots.
Well, that sounds like a good investment to getting that information out there. And I bet if you get the raw information out there, then there's some kid in their basement is going to come out with some new model.
Sure.
That will possibly revolutionize some of the things that you can even do and push the models even farther.
You never know.
It sounds like you've had a great career, and I'm sure you've seen some interesting things during your time at the National Weather Service.
Oh, yeah, and everything technology just keeps increasing at a fast pace.
Sure, yeah. Well, thanks for everything you're doing.
And welcome. We do appreciate you coming in. Again, this has been Rich Mamrosch with the National Weather Service, and you're listening to EAA Radio.